All right. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Larry Connolly Radio Show. I, of course, as usual, am not Larry Connolly. I'm David Connolly, the better version, what some like to call Larry 2.0. But anyway, I'm here to not plug me this week. I'm here to introduce Larry. He's going to introduce our fabulous guest as well as the rest of the glue crew. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, our host, our fearless leader, Captain Larry Connolly.
What happened to the
maybe in the 2020 budget?
He's the guy.
Not this time. No, sir. Funding got cut. You know.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll just get started. Keep tuning in to a holiday edition of Larry Connolly Radio Show, and hope everybody had a happy holidays. There's a Merry Christmas and Happy Kwanzaa and Happy Hanukkah. And happy. So this is just a happy time of the year, and I just glad to see another one. And it's also a time of the year that fires have increased. I know they've increased here in St. Louis, and we've had tragically a couple of kids that were that perished in the fire about a week ago. And so I just want to take this moment to stress that wherever you listening to this from, make sure that those smoke detectors, or if you in charge of making sure that's happening in your community, get those, make sure people are educated about those smoke detectors, because we see too many times, you know, people this close to the door not making it out. And this smoke could get you before the fire does. And unfortunately, that's what happened with the tragedy we had here in St. Louis a short time ago. So this is a time where everybody's trying to be warm and all that, but make sure those smoke detectors are in. So a little PSA, a little plug to make sure that we all stay safe and make it through this happy season that's supposed to be happy. Moving right along, we... Dave and I are going to be pretty busy going into the new year. And so be sure to check the website, www.gluenationldc.com, and check us out. We'll be doing some things here in Missouri. We'll be in Jackson, Missouri on the later on this month. And then we'll be in Fenton, Missouri, and then we'll be down in Florida, Disney World. So we're going to be getting out pretty good, and definitely the icing on the cake of the spring is always when we end up at FDIC, the Super Bowl of conferences in there, out there in Indianapolis. So we always look forward to doing that and can't wait to get out there again. I always feel like, David, and I know that, you know, me and you have talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
Me personally, I always feel like when I go there, you know, especially for firefighters, you know, we've been working all year. We've been, you know, battling some blazes and doing some things, helping people, just really working our tails off in a lot of cases. And when we get there, it's like you're taking a breath of air, like, whew, another year has passed, and we're here to celebrate this great career called firefighting. And so it's always a great time. I know the first time David went, David was like, you know, yeah, it sounds like a fun conference, but God, boy, you guys are really into it. It's not like, you know, you go to other conferences and for other industries, and they, you know, just wear badges and get cars outfitted with decals and just, you know, just a whole cult following that we have. But it's to celebrate one of the greatest careers in the world. Mm-hmm. And being kind of a layman in this whole thing, you know, how does that strike you when you go to when you show up at FDIC and we do our class there?
Yeah, I mean, I've adjusted now a little bit, and it's you know, always a good time. You meet a bunch of great people. Some of the first, you know, few times I went, it's interesting because, you know, you grew up thinking if you see that many first responders in one place, you probably need to get out of the area. Something bad is going down. But this is really the opposite of that. It's, like I said, everybody's really nice, and it's just a really like a family atmosphere to it. And so that's really great. A lot of learning, a lot of sharing of ideas, and just a lot of positivity in that way. And so always a great time, always a great time.
Mm-hmm. Good deal. So on the show, as usual, we have David, so my fearless partner in crime as we travel the highways and byways of the world, spreading the GLU personal leadership message. And then also we have our advisor and our disciplinarian and our research and development guru, which is Miss Elaine. And that brings up what we call the GLU crew. However, tonight we are very excited to have a very dear friend and somebody I've met, like, I think probably almost 20 years ago, and we kind of met by accident. He was in town helping us develop strategies for the promotional exams here in St. Louis, and we talked, and his funny thing, we went out afterwards and kind of talked about the class after the class was over, and started talking about some gritty things that were going on that he noticed, and I was helping him confirm about relationships that are supposed to be intimate as far as the fire service is concerned, because we got each other's back in life and death. But sometimes little things like, race and things like that get in the way. We had just met each other, but we had a real frank talk about a few issues regarding that, and how can we work together to, help change things. You're not going to change everything and all things, especially overnight, but definitely what can we do to make some changes to continue to be one family and without a lot of dissension, and one family that, help each other. Because if we can't help each other, then how are we going to trust that we're going to help people that we don't know in the street when we head out for that type of help? But from there, develop a really cool and unique relationship over the years. And I'm very proud to call him a friend, a mentor, and I've called for advice at times and got some very good sage advice. And the cool thing is that it's not always just a straight advice, so to speak. It's always backed up with a really wise story that goes along with it that really puts things in context. And some of that has rubbed off on me because it helps when I do my presentations and talk to people. When you have a timely, wise story to really bring it all home, I just think it takes a special gift, and I've been trying to chase and develop that gift ever since I met.
Much to my chagrin on the road, you have no idea how many of these stories are being tested out on me in our one-on-ones. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
This would be working. But without further ado, I want to introduce our guest and our friend and our big brother and all around. I don't know. It's too many. The show is not long enough to describe.
Another mother.
You guys are killing me. What's the line out of that movie? You're killing me, Smalls. just to correct you, it's over 25 years ago. Yeah. That we met, and it was a promotional thing. I came into St. Louis and working with a friend of mine, and we were doing some training. And oddly enough, Larry, I don't know if you remember, but Derek and Rob were both in that class,
right.
And they would lose their lives together in that automotive fire a year or two later, maybe probably only a year later. It was a short time, and amazingly, it was as you mentioned, 20 years ago, we had some really interesting, things going on in St. Louis, and as everyone knows, and a lot of it revolved around, race, and which was interesting. And fire were bringing in speakers, and the union guys were bringing in speakers, and I came in to speak for both groups, just by pure coincidence. And so it was a wonderful time to see people coming together. And what was fascinating was the night that Derek and Rob lost their lives, Rob went in first, and Derek, Rob became disoriented and trapped out of there. And Derek, although he had been already involved in operations, rather than take the time to change out his bottle, and he knew that seconds mattered to, if he was going to try to save Rob, went back in, and they were found within feet of one another. They died together, and Derek was African-American, Rob was white, and that night, none of that mattered. And quite frankly, it's never mattered to people who, you know, Dr. King told us best, it's the content of your character. How much melanin is in your skin, or what kind of genitals you have, or who you make love to is really irrelevant to your humanity. And I think that the really important thing about a lot of what we do with glue and a lot of what we do with FDIC and a lot of what the message that we send is, irrespective of any other standing you may have in life, all we care about is your humanity, period. We don't care if you're Portuguese or French or Italian or South African or Irish or Scandinavian, or, you know, you could be the president of the United States, or you could be a poor guy who, you know, panhandles on East 32nd Street. We treat you the same, and we care about you the same, and we love you the same. And I think that that's a message that, especially this time of year, well, all year long, needs to get out. Thomas Jefferson once said it very well. He said, "A man's ideology, his politics, or his race are no reason for me not to be his friend." And Kennedy once mentioned he had 17 Nobel laureates to dinner at the White House. And he said, "This is probably the finest collection of intellect that's ever dined in the White House, with the exception of when Jefferson dined alone." Which is high praise for the man. But I think that the glue message is beyond even, it's about respect, and it's about dignity. And that's why the glue message is so important, because everyone, from God, and not from the state, not from the government, God created us all in his image and likeness. And that's where our rights and our dignity and our humanity come from, not from some bureaucrat in anywhere. And I'll stop with that.
Well said, very well put, and you're right. I mean, we talk about that all the time, where we are interested in the humanity of people, and that cuts like a hot knife through butter when it comes to getting to the core of the ideals of who we are and who we are to each other. And we really try to bring that out when we do the class. From a lot of leadership stuff that you've seen over the years, Elaine, I know you've talked about this before, seeing what you see and seeing what we do and why we do it and the things that we discuss, what's your take on that whole thing? Because I know you grew up during the era, and we've talked about this in detail, you grew up during the era where, you know, you, in a lot of ways, you had to, in order just to be a nurse and be in your profession, you know, you had to fight for your identity as far as being a, you know, African-American and what was expected and what you had to go up against. And so I know that can taint you sometime in thinking like, you know, everything is black and white, or everything is gender-based, or everything is based on who has the dominant culture and things. But, you know, how do you see things now compared to then, and also understanding, you know, the humanity of things being greater than, you know, the things that we put the wrong emphasis on?
Well, I think that it's interesting that it was a lot more prevalent and in your face sometimes for me personally, that I would run into blatant racism. But through the years, I've even come to the conclusion that sometimes the person who was being that way, they almost came across in retrospect like they didn't know any other way to come across, because they had been so programmed to think a certain way. And but I noticed too in nursing, if a patient got in trouble, and depending on the level of trouble they were in, they didn't care who came to their rescue. So when I showed up, they didn't say, oh no, I'm not gonna let you touch me. I'm, you know, going into cardiac arrest, or I'm having trouble breathing or whatever it is. And they wouldn't let me touch them. That was never the case. So it depends on, you know, when you get in a crisis, sometimes certain things just go out of the window. But usually in my, you know, everyday kind of activities, especially in that particular profession. And one of the other things too is that it was, the school that I went to was very few African Americans even in the whole school. So it was predominantly Caucasians. So people are going to necessarily gravitate toward what they know best. But I had to learn myself too to just not let that deter me, because some people would drop out because they couldn't take the pressures and all those kinds of things. And so between my regular education, elementary school, high school, and then nursing school, I was always outnumbered by Caucasians. And so I just, you know, learned to fit in where I fit in and not care about whether I did fit in certain areas. But in today's world, I think that we seem to have a lot more people who are a lot more conscious about what's going on, and seem to me to be trying to correct things that need to be corrected. But I think that I don't think there's ever not going to be some diehard about how people.
Well, wouldn't you say too, though, Elaine, that I think especially for you and I and our generation, a lot of it was a lack of familiarity, and a lot of that's just gone. You know what I mean? In terms of the social mobility of everybody today is so much greater. And I think that that's really helping make things better, because one of the things I think that people tend to gravitate towards folks that are like them, whether it's the same trade or the same interests or whatever. And I think that now with all the greater mobility and for people, that things are, I think, markedly different than when you and I were kids.
Well, also I think that, and I, this is how I talk, this is how I cope with all of it, is it's hard for me to believe a person could be groomed and raised and trained, and this is all they know. And then they get to a certain point where they have to work around other people, whatever that those other people are. Because even for men and women, you know, sometimes you have a male-dominated profession, you have a female-dominated profession. Females and males have a hard time getting along, even if they're the same ethnicity, same race. So I think a lot of times my way of thinking now is, it's just difficult to change some of the things where you were raised to think and you've been conditioned to think a certain way. But now, like you said, I think people are getting, you know, they have a whole lot more ways to communicate than they used to have, a whole lot more ways to interact. And so, like you said, the mobility and ability to get around other people and things like that. But for me personally, it took me a while, but I just came to the conclusion, because a whole lot of things in the ways I was raised and taught to think, you can't go here, you can't go there, you know, that kind of thing. I had to get rid of that eventually, because after a while I could go anywhere in it. So I think everybody may have some, a lot of people, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people I think are just doing what they're used to. And then they find something new, and then they decide, well, I can make a choice to try to grow out of the areas in my growing up and in my conditioning that maybe don't fit anymore or should never have fit. Maybe it just wasn't the way to be. And now I think I should be more tolerant, if that answers what you think for the same.
So here's an interesting one for you, and I'll throw this out. So I want to get everybody's reaction on this. So it's interesting. So there was an old philosopher, I can't think of his name, but Douglas Murray brought up a concept that this guy threw out years ago, and it's called St. George in retirement. And so St. George, obviously the dragon slayer, goes out and slays the dragon, right? And, okay, great, you're the big hero, the dragon slayed. Now what? now what? So you got St. George in retirement. And I think that part of what we're seeing in the process is that for some people, things like using immutable characteristics as wedges between people, whether it's race or gender or religion or whatever, not religion, that's not immutable, but I mean, obviously physical appearance, they use that as a weapon to try to divide people, because for them, it's a cottage industry. They've got, you know, they can then either be the hero or champion. So it's like St. George in retirement. But I think the big issue that big dragon has been slayed. I just want to hear what you guys had to think about that.
And the dragon's name is racism?
Well, yeah, I think a whole bunch of isms, if you will. I mean, and phobias. I think that, you know, the 20 years ago, people were still, you know, unsure about homosexuality and all of that. They were still, you know, there was feminism, you know, 40, 50 years ago started to take hold. And I think that, you know, racism 40, 50 years ago really started to, people really started to deal with it directly. And I think now it's, you know, you're a major outlier if you still think that that's a good, any of those were a good idea.
The only thing about that, Bobby, is the fact that we're still saying the first this and the first that. So I think it may be on life support, but I'm not sure it's slang. Because why would you still be saying the first woman to do so-and-so, the first Black person to be this or that, first, you know what I'm saying? We still kind of, even in this era, why would you, after all these years, that the dragon was slain, would you still be the first?
Well, I think that's exactly what we are seeing now. In other words, I think that because the big dragon has been slain, but just like St. George in retirement, what do you do now, right? In other words, slaying the dragon was just the big issue. It's the smaller ancillary issues that I think you address from that, and you're seeing the successes, because you just said it, the first this, the first that. And then there just are going to be places where they were male-dominated activities because, well, women frankly didn't want to do it, just like there are things that women do that, well, frankly, men weren't inclined to want to do. And this isn't right or wrong or good or bad. There's a certain amount of biology and work that people have done, you know, that look into those things. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I know that I've read papers on people who said that there's a certain inclination for men to be more inclined towards mechanical things, whereas women are more inclined towards things that are, you know, physical and human and that type of thing. Whereas, so there you see the nursing versus auto mechanic or that type of thing. But I think those things will change over time, and it'll be more accepted for people to move in between those professions and those interests. So, and I don't know that those were major dragons in any way, but I think that that's just kind of an indication of the mobility, right? That, you know, that in the past, all nurses were women, period, and all firefighters were men. And now that's changing, and that's a good thing. More inclusivity, more access. Where I think it gets dangerous, and I hear it sometimes, is where people believe that in order to accelerate it or whatever, that they create artificial quotas, they try to force people into it rather than allowing that inclusion to happen evolutionarily or naturally. And I also think that they start to ascribe qualities to people, like a sense of superiority or whatnot. And I've seen that in several discussions where someone said, well, women are better leaders. Well, the jury's still out on that. There'll be a millennia before we can make any kind of decision about what gender leads best. And certainly there's no indication at this point that either one of them do a very good job at it. So, I'll just leave it with, you know, Bloody Mary and Adolf Hitler are two examples of people, different genders, who are both lousy leaders. So, just a thought.
I think the notion that dragon is dead, I mean, it's an interesting way, I guess, to put it, but it's dead in the sense that there is a general feeling, I think, that we should be more open to inclusivity now than back when that was just not even a thought. If you thought that you were the outlier, you know, I think that it's in that way, it may be, but I would rather say it's different now, because the thing is not, to me, necessarily the first this or the first that, because the openness of the thinking allows for the first this or first that, but the reaction a lot of times to the fact that you have the first whatever, that reaction is not always celebratory. And so that's the place where I say, well, maybe it's on life support in that way, because you would think that there would be, you know, like an overwhelming embracing of that, but a lot of times it's not. A lot of times people face, at its mildest, the general challenge that you're not capable of doing it because you're not the people who usually have done it, whatever that role was, you know, whether it's a male female thing or a race thing or whatever. So I think, and Larry and I were at a diversity conference, and we were having a general, you know, discussion, a lot of people talking about things, and they were talking about legislating diversity and inclusivity and things like that. And one of the things I remember saying and thinking about it is, you can try and legislate it all day long, but it becomes like an SOP. So while I'm here, I have to operate this way, you know, as opposed to, let me try to enhance the individual. Let me try to grow the individual. Let me try to grow the humanity of these people to where diversity and inclusion is just the way a person gets down, as opposed to something that somebody says, do this or there's this sanction. You know what I mean? You actually understand that I'm going to adhere to the notion that we are brothers and sisters in the fire service, and really believe that if you go, we go, sort of mentality that's out there, and that become, for that to become more than rhetoric in the individual's life is the real change. And maybe sometimes you gotta, you know, prompt that through some SOGs or whatever, but I think that when it's really going to be a change, when it's really going to be something that you can see, is the change is when that is with everybody, or at least, you know, like the overwhelming majority, to where you don't even hear the folks who have anything negative to say about it, or it's not even a threat, you know, because you would hear certain people where they feel like going back to their departments or whatever, they know certain people, certain groups that they're going to have to deal with, being the first whatever, or being the first this in this house, even, you know, or whatever. So the fact that sort of apprehension and anxiety, which is a real thing, still exists is, you know, an interesting fact. Especially now, what I think is interesting is, with all the access that we have to each other, to information about cultures and places, the world is a lot smaller in that way, knowledge-wise, than it was, you know, say, back when we were talking about how a lot of this thinking was prevalent. It's smaller now. People have more access to the information, but it's kind of like lately kind of a backlash, even, where you see things like, you know, shootings at stores and people acting out in a way that's like sort of a desperation to hold on to that sort of polarized thinking, you know. So that's what I mean. I agree about the life support thing, I think.
I think you're exactly right. But I also think what's neat is that I've gone places and I said, well, you know, back in the day I was like this, and I've had young people look at me and they'd go, really? And that's how we know we're winning, because they think it's always been this way. That they don't realize what it was like years ago. And that's a good thing in some regards, and it's a bad thing in some regards.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was getting ready to also say that I think what helps these days is the social distance is different, and I've been kind of studying that lately. And when you talk about the social distance back in the day when communication wasn't as close as it is now, the world wasn't as small, as far as communication and things, information getting out is quick. You had the little gray area, the little gap, the little loophole where you can be in your own little world, your own little cocoon, and believe the lies and the rhetoric about another race, gender, or a different culture. And if you had the power to not embrace it or very well exclude it, you could, and that got in the way of a lot of progress, progressive thoughts and progress in different races and gender and things like that. But now that the social distance is different, you got more people, you got interracial marriages, and you got, like I said, information getting out a lot faster than they used to, then people are making better decisions about that. And when they make better decisions about it, then we now are hopefully dealing with people more on their character and not, their color, their skin, or their gender and things like that. So I think it's the social distance is a double-edged sword. It, number one, puts more people in your business than ever before. But at the same token, it knocks down a lot of myths and things that you probably believed, and myths that were passed down through, your family, your communities. And now you realize you can see for yourself that that's not necessarily true. And now anybody who tries to go back to that pretty much sound like a dinosaur. So hopefully we're winning in that regard as well.
Yeah, I think words like social distance. I'm just happy to hear you say those things.
But I think that's the dragon, right? I think that St. George killed the big dragon. Now, there's always little followers, rabid dogs and weasels that are going to have to be exterminated, as Larry said and Elaine said, people that cling to things that are obviously dysfunctional, no longer useful, and bad, just inherently bad. There's a moral aspect to everything we're talking about, a serious moral aspect. And I don't think that anybody can say that that's not really, really important. And that's why I think that, we need to talk about morals and ethics and principles. And you mentioned interracial marriage. I live in a little tiny 29 home community outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, very, very rural. There are two interracial couples on our neighborhood, and nobody, nobody notices. I mean, it's just okay. When I was a kid, and this is a true story, I'm at my grandma's house, and I come from an Irish Catholic, Spanish, family, and big family, 12 of my mom, 7 of my dad, and they were all cops, firemen, or priests. It was Irish welfare. You had to, be a cop, fireman, or a priest. So there was a big Donnybrook at the kitchen table one day, and my uncles were all arguing and complaining, and my Uncle Georgie spouts out, "Boy, these guys just coming into the department here, they're destroying the fabric of the department. They don't, they don't eat the same foods we do. Their names ends in vowels and such, I can't stand these guys." And so my dad jumps in and he says, "Hey, Georgie, what's wrong with you, man? The black guys are cool guys. I work with a couple of guys down in the Bronx. You're way off base with this, man. You gotta get your head right." And Georgie looks at him and goes, "Bobby, what are you talking about black guys? Why? I got no talk with black guys. It's these dang guineas coming into the Bronx. They don't belong here." He meant the Italian people. That was a problem for him. You show how petty and small and silly people can be. This guy, the Bronx is for the Irish, Brooklyn's for the Italians. And that was a dogma to this guy. But it's what he grew up with, and it was what, you know what I mean? And it was the pecking order of the day, you had the Irish pecking, you had the German pecking order, you had the Russian Jews who came in the 1980s. And there's always that dominance hierarchy in any mammal species. If you look at the animals and you look at people, there's a dominance hierarchy, and people adhere to it, and it changes, and it blends, and it gets different, and it just happens. And now, what we're talking about now is that society is moving so fast, and there's so much blending and moving, and that it's, almost irrespective of your immutable characteristics, whether it's your gender, your race, your, whatever, your physical appearance. It's about merit. It's about what Dr. King taught us. It's about your character. It's about your skill set. And that is a good thing. that is a really good thing. And I think where Murray has a good point with St. George in retirement is the people who are trying to retard it are the very people you were talking about. The people are saying we need laws, we need the point of a gun, government, to force people to do it. That is not a solution. You want to continue the problem? That's how you continue the problem.
Right. You can't legislate people getting along, and that's what happens. I remember when, and I recognized parts of that when I was growing up, and even though I didn't realize all the nuances of it because I wasn't old enough, you know how you just get that inner feeling that something's not right. I remember when I was in high school, they decided to desegregate the city, the St. Louis City school system, and they were gonna, you know, have the city kids go out to the county, and you know, some of the county kids were coming down to the city, but mainly to get us out to the county. And the thought pattern was that if we go out there, then of course we're gonna get, you know, better education and learn better. And so it was a forced system, and the busing was a huge budget, and it still is in a lot of cases. Sometimes busing actually keeps schools closed because if it's warm, they don't want the buses out on the road, opposed to when we make tell that age old story, oh, we walked through 3 feet of snow. Well, the reason part of that's true because your school was down the street, and you didn't have to get up at Old Door 30 to catch the bus out. But the deal is that the reason that didn't totally work is because it wasn't the whole segregation and things like that. It was based on the fact that if I moved to a predominantly white neighborhood, I was basically told, and in some cases stopped, that I could not go to that school. That was the problem. It's not that if you just put me in that system, then all of a sudden, then I'm gonna be, you know, I'm forced to be in that system. Because if you put the same people, the same staffing, the same books, the same quality of education in the inner city schools, then it's cool. Everybody's learning the same thing. We don't have to get up at 4:30 in the morning. But when you're trying to legislate that I should get along with a different race of people, based on the fact that I'm forced to be bused there, and you're trying to legislate relationships and education and things like that, it just, to me, never really worked. And in a lot of ways, it depleted the neighborhoods, the schools. There's a ton of, I just did a paper on it earlier this year for school, on how a lot of these neighborhood schools that were beautiful buildings, and hardwood floors and great windows and nice playgrounds and stuff are sitting empty right now because they shut the schools down. But a lot of the county schools are still thriving because the census is up and people still are getting up early in the morning being legislated to go get along with people that's not in their neighborhood. The difference wasn't that I have to go there. The difference was that if I move there, I should be able to go there, but not just getting me up out of my neighborhood and making me go there. And I just think that kind of is the template for a lot of things that we do, just like David was talking about earlier. You know, you're going to put in the SOG, you get along with this person, or else there are going to be consequences. You know, we need to be working on more of striking the core of the humanity of each other, and then let that organically play out to the good of who we are, instead of making you do it by law. We're always going to resist that, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And I want to say, like, I think part of the thing too with the busing was that you think, okay, well, the education of the schools that don't have these resources and stuff is substandard, and we'd like to have the same level of education as, say, these schools in different area of town. So the answer to that is then to take you to those schools, as opposed to bringing the quality of the materials and the environment and the teaching and all of that up to you know, the level of those better schools. So what you did was you said, and this is what I think is summing up what Larry's saying the problem is, and kind of what you find is that people inherently start thinking that different means deficient. So whenever you say, okay, the inner city school versus this school, the inner city school is now seen as deficient. So we're going to send you to the better school, as opposed to making sure just that all the schools are operating on the same level. That's not happening, because how you value the schools in the inner city is not as high as what you value schools in the other part of the city. So now taking the resources, being the young minds out of those schools, diminishes the value of the neighborhood and the school even further. You know, it's interesting. I had some films and scripts and stuff win some awards at some different film festivals. One of the best ones I've ever gone to is the African American, they call it the ABFF, the American Black Film Festival. It's one of the best run, best overall quality of films there. But when you tell folks, well, you got accepted to that or you won awards, when you say the American, if you say the American Film Festival, that's a certain prestige. If you say the American Black, the minute you say Black, people have this look in their face like it suddenly went down about 50 points. When it's a prestigious film festival as well, I'm saying with regard to the number, the level of the celebrities that are there, the legends that are there with regard to people in front of and behind the camera, the opportunities that are there for you to get stuff produced and everything. It's like the real deal. And so it's interesting though, because people who have no knowledge of film at all, they hear Black and it drops because they think different is deficient. So until we address, and that's what I'm saying, like even when we talk about it in the class, when you start looking at everybody with equal high status and you just commit yourself to saying everybody has equal high status and I'm going to treat them that way, I'm going to go out of my way, I'm going to train that muscle inside of me, in my heart and in my soul to do that, then you stop looking at everybody, because their contribution is as valuable as your contribution to the team. But if you don't look at it like that, you look at this person as different and therefore they're deficient, then you know it's hard to come back from that and everything. And that's how you start inherently doing things that keep them in that deficient place, because that's what makes you comfortable, you know. And so I think that's
well, and I think those are great points. I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's really interesting. You know, Will Rogers said it best. He said, "We're all ignorant, just different subjects, but people are very reluctant to admit their ignorance on almost anything. Everybody wants to act like they know what's going on, or they understand, or they've got the answer, or they've got a plan. Nothing could be further from the truth." And, you know, besides the racial discrimination, think about the geographic discrimination. If you tell somebody, I get it nowadays, you say, "Well, I'm from Oklahoma. I live in Oklahoma." People treat me like I'm Barney Rubble or something. You know what I mean? Whereas they say, "Oh, I'm from New York City." "Oh, well, you're from New York City. I was born in New York City, but you know, oh, I live in Oklahoma." That's interesting. Think about how people treat people with a heavy Southern accent. Right away, they think they're simple-minded. Really? Do that piece of math. You know what I mean? They write off an entire section of the country because they speak differently,
right?
Which is amazing. But people tend to do that. And good luck with changing all of that. I think it's getting better. I mean, I think the real wonder for me and the beauty for me living to see it is that I look at my grandkids and they understand what Dr. King meant. We got to hear him live. You know, we got to experience that. At least Elaine and I did. We got to be part of that moment. But my grandkids are living the benefit of his wisdom and his eloquence. They get it. They probably never heard the words, but they're living it, you know. And they're out in Raleigh, North Carolina, and you know, they think they don't have any of these, you know, imprints on them. And I think they're imprints, like, you know, how animals imprint on owners, and animals, you know, imprint on, you know, the ducks follow the mother duck and they learn different behaviors. I think people do the same thing. And I think much of that is a dead dragon. And it's not to say there still aren't, you know, the occasional pockets of ignorance and stupidity. There are on both sides of the aisle. But it is getting so much better that I hope someday that St. George is completely retired and you know, can put his saber away. And I think it's getting there. I mean, I'm very upset with these people who are trying to, you know, create more, you know, classifications and more division. Stop it. You know what I mean? Just stop it. Just enjoy one another. Let it go. You know, I don't think we need to have, you know, equal numbers of women on every board and equal numbers of, you know, this group on every board, or that gets crazy. That's stupid. It's just stupid. Let the people who want to be there, who earn the right to be there, who deserve to be there, regardless of who they are, regardless of what they are. And I think we're getting there. I really do. I think that the ignorance of the other side of that argument is just appalling.
Do you think, I'm sorry.
One of the things I wanted to say is, when you talked about legislating,
it is
troublesome that some things have to be legislated. And the reason why is because the legislation said no so-and-so's allowed. Whatever the race was, whatever the ethnicity was, whatever the gender was, there was legislation previously that said no allowed, you're not allowed. I mean, when I was a kid and even into my adulthood, there were places that I could not go to eat a meal, right. A restaurant. Some of these places were like fast food kind of places, and for their time. And you know, so then in order to get rid of that, I guess a law had to then be passed to make that owner or whoever was in charge or whatever, they would only change it because of a law. And so,
well, I think those are laws, Elaine, that we wanted to just have taken away, just removed, just ended, because they were bad. They were intentionally racist, and they were intentionally segregationist, and those were bad. But to create laws to force people to integrate or force people to have so many women here or so many men there, that is equally as bad. Tyranny in any form, in my opinion, is wrong. Forcing people to do anything. Let nature's God move us in the ways that we were meant to move. And those are good ways. I don't think that there's anybody in Washington who I think is intelligent enough to do social engineering, quite frankly, or in any government anywhere. I've never seen any indication of it. Soviet man would probably be the most widespread example of it. And look how well that turned out. You know, we're seeing that kind of tyranny in communist China, and it's not a good thing, and it's never a good thing, and it will eventually cause their fall. You can tyrannize people for only so long, and then they finally say no more.
Well, some of the only thing about that, though, now, for instance, when you came to the school systems and stuff like that, that was legislated. But if I owned a restaurant and I was a Caucasian back in the day, there was no law that said your person couldn't eat at your restaurant. You said I couldn't eat in your restaurant. And so because you weren't allowing anybody in your restaurant or in your neighborhood or whatever, then somebody had to pass a law to make you do it.
Oh no, and I totally understand that. I totally get that those had to be that had to be stopped. But by the same token, you know, back in that day, you and I couldn't get married in probably half the states in the country probably wouldn't have allowed us to get married. But today, man, that is just, sorry about the noise. I'm actually outside in the park walking my dogs. Taking advantage of some good weather. But I think that, yeah, those things, but those are the slain dragons, and we should keep them dead.
But what killed the dragon? The law that they passed, correct?
No, I think attitudes. I think attitudes force them to. I think that education and knowledge and just common sense and love force people to stop being able to use the law as a weapon. I don't think more weapons via the law are the answer at all. I mean, we could disagree on it. I mean, I love you, but you know, if you want to force people to be nice to each other by law, good luck.
I know personally that were one of them was like a middle end kind, you know, kind of high end restaurant. The other one was more would have been more like a fast food place, not a chain, but a fast food place. They both, when they passed the law that said you have to let Black people come in and eat in your facility, your restaurant, they both closed down rather than do that.
Well, what's so sad, and in some places in America, say there are college campuses where there are dormitories that I can't be, I'm not allowed to go into because they're only for minority students. So now I can't go into some of those dormitories because they're so-called safe spaces. So, I think that is just as hateful and just as ignorant and just as wrong.
Yeah, I'm saying it was wrong, but I'm saying that if a place is, it wasn't that there was a law to begin with that said these people couldn't eat there. It was the person who owned the restaurant, the person who owned the business. They said, we won't serve you. We won't do this. So how do you get them to do it? They rather close down than serve you, or rather close down than to let you in their store to buy products and stuff, and to let you in your grocery store. So only way they got to do it, and I agree on one level that people should be able to do.
I think we both agree that there should be no law made that allows anyone to discriminate against anyone else, period. For any reason, there should be no law that allows anyone to discriminate against anyone else. But we're seeing a return to some of those discriminatory practices in some places, and you know, now, albeit with the social warrior kind of, you know, woke nonsense, which is all based on, you know, pseudoscience, unless you're a postmodernist and you believe Derrida, Foucault, or any of these other French knuckleheads, in my opinion. And obviously I don't, but I just think there's a very dangerous path to go down when it comes to legislating equality. That was the difference between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. We had life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They had egalite, equality. Look at how it's working out for them now. Not so much.
Because they weren't ever talking about everybody to begin with.
Exactly.
All men created equal. They weren't talking about Black men and women. They were talking about Caucasian men.
Well, so that's an interesting construct. If you read Jefferson deeply, he really was talking about it. In his subsequent papers and letters, I mean, there's so much evidence of how he felt about the whole issue that's contrary. The problem was how the British had set up our nation prior to our nation becoming its own nation, and the constructs that the British had brought over in terms of slavery and it was an economic system in the South, and that horrible institution was what, you know, caused all of that to go so horribly wrong. And it was horrible from the beginning, and it still is. And yet around the world today, there are still places that are practicing slavery, which is just insane. But, you know, people forget that it's not a dead institution. There are places in the world where people are enslaved.
I just think that a lot of the times when people are speaking, you know, from their experiences, you definitely are going to be affected, and you're going to experience things, you know, differently. And I can remember just, you know, sitting at my mother's feet, hearing some of the things she had to go through and being a Black female. And the painful thing about it is she was very capable in everything she set herself off to be, but it was just, you know, you can't do it because of who you are. I mean, in some cases, I don't know if it was the law or not, but they was able to enforce it where, you know, she had to fight, and then maybe, you know, other you know, people and other races didn't have to experience the same thing. And then because the problem is I think there's a lot of ideology that was maybe, you know, noble and good, and in the perfect world it would have worked out. However, how the law was carried out, or how the things were disseminated, didn't always work out for, you know, depending on who was marginalized at the time, you know. And because I'm telling you, going back now, being in school and rereading a lot of American history, I'm in American history class now, and it's amazing how you read things and see both sides. It's funny to hear me listen to you too, because on one end, they talk about, you know, the margin, you know, how people marginalized and the women's suffrage and you know, the black people, you know, coming back from the war, and they were treated like kings and queens over in France, but they get back here and they couldn't even go, you know, sit at the lunch counter. And then on the other end, you got these great minds who, you know, wrote the Constitution and you know, had a very good concept on how things should be and how fair it should be. And then by the time it disseminated down to maybe, you know, a brother or sister that was working in the South, they didn't get the ideal thing, you know. And unfortunately, they even spin that even deeper, like you were saying earlier, Bob, you know, is you had even discrimination against if you were white, because you were this type of white or that type of white. So it's, you know, the ideology of things and sometimes how they shake out don't always add up, and some people just get it worse. And I know that's a lot of challenges we face, even in the fire service, you know, where I talked to Carl Holmes for a long time before he died, and some of the stories he told me, just being Carl Holmes in Oklahoma, was like, wow, you know, it's the way you came up out of that and how well you, you know, was almost like a coal and a pearl type of mentality, you know, the pressure you went through and still was able to evolve and leave an impact on the American fire service, and not be bitter about it, but just be, you know, be driven by the fact that I just want to make it better, no matter where I am or who I am or where I came from. Amazing stories, and amazing stories is coming from everybody.
And I think what's so neat is you have to remember that Carl Holmes and your mom and I all grew up in the same time. And to you were going, wow, you couldn't believe it. That's good. That's a good sign. And I want to hear kids say wow about many, many more things that are going to get better and better. But I think we need to be careful about how we do it and not try to do it at the point of a gun.
But, you know, the other thing about that, and this is, I guess, the uncomfortable truth, is that, like, before I went to school, like, at across town at the, I went to a school called Ames. It's the first school I got bused to. Before I went there, I never encountered white people to the degree that I did when I went to that school. So I never even had that sort of cultural exchange, had the opportunity to see the similarities and the differences and whatever, things that I think made me a better person overall, you know. I hadn't had those experiences, and had I not been busted, I'm not so sure when that would have happened, or if it would have been somehow an agent of retardation for me socially as I, you know, grew older. So I guess I'm saying that to say some of the legislation to do that is what I think put people in a position to say, you know what, I can safely open up. I don't think a lot of people did that just like they were one day racist and the next day kumbaya. I think that there was a thing where over the generations it happened because you kind of forced people to look at each other as opposed to deal with just stereotypes. I mean, most of the time when you start dealing with just straight, you know, racism, it's like ignorance on a level you wouldn't believe. Like some of the conversations I've had with people who were brave enough to actually sit down with me and have those conversations, the way they thought about Black people was incredible to me. Like where literally a guy asked me one time, one of his questions was, do you guys fight amongst each other? Like, yeah, we just do that till we find, you know, the alpha male and then we all bow down. It was, yeah, but I mean, that's the thinking, you know, like when I used to be.
Well, all you'd have to do is play them in the open. All you had to do is play them the opening of this radio show. Do we fight with another YouTube characters?
Right. But, you know, I'm saying all that to say, I think you need to have people be in a position where they can have that sort of interaction with each other and learn that, hey, this guy is cool just because he's cool. He's none of his stuff is based solely on him being white, Black, or indifferent. And if you don't have that, well, and you continue to let people be separate and whatever, then you're never going to. So I think in that way, having some of the legislation help. Now, do I think that, let me say this right quick. I agree completely with you. I think you shouldn't have to force people to say this many women need to be on this or this many Black people need to be on. The only problem with people who are traditionally marginalized is they have a very substantiated concern that if you do not have something that says that, they will not then be represented, because that's what history has shown. It's not like folks have necessarily gone out of their way without some outside pressure to make that happen. You rarely have a situation where they say, well, you know what, we kind of need some new blood in here. Larry's cool, blah, blah, blah. But when you're thinking different is deficient, you automatically think Larry cannot handle it because he's Black or where he comes from or wherever. I'm saying that's been the traditional thinking.
I think those are great points, and I apologize, but I promised my family I would only take an hour, so I'm going to have to get back to the family here. But a couple of things. I think one of the things you have to be so careful about is the bigotry of low expectations, and that was really prevalent in the 60s and the 70s, where people who were albeit with the best of intentions, were lowering standards and doing things like this and doing all kinds of stuff, which they thought would make people, you know, get into positions or whatever. And that's why I worry about things that get legislated, because all that crap was legislated, and it was crap. You know, it was just crap, and it did nothing to help raise anyone who they supposedly were trying to help. If anything, it retarded people's ability to get into these institutions and organizations and by merit, which is what Dr. King preached for forever. And I think now it's gotten so much better. And I just hate to see us take, you know, one step forward and two steps back. And in some places I see that happening with this incredible, you know, vulcanization of identity, whether, and especially when it's something that's immutable. I mean, you know, if you want to have vulcanization by ideology and dogma, good for you. We can argue that all day long. But I can't change the fact of who I am, and I can't change the fact of how I was born, what color I am, and what gender I am. Those things don't change. And society has been changing for 6,000 years or so, and since we've been, you know, seriously organized. Some people say 8, but and I think it's better. And I just think that the fire service is in a great place, and I think it's getting greater. And I think that you know, as a firefighter, from what I see of it, I think we're the vanguard of that, you know, of that really kind of open, inclusive environment. And I like it. I'm proud of it, and I'm proud of what the fire service is doing and where we are and how we're handling it. And I think the fact that we're resisting this incredible pressure to vulcanize by, you know, sexuality and gender and race, which is happening in the American political spectrum. I think the fact that we're resisting that is commendable, and I think it's important. So I appreciate the discussion today, but I think even this discussion shows, you know, how far the American Fire Service has come. You know, and you look at, you know, you guys are going to be keynoting, Larry and David are going to be keynoting at FDIC. We've had Lenny Carmichael up there. John Austin is going to be, you know, speaking for us this year, Thursday. And, you know, so it's, you know, it's, I don't know. I'm, you know, maybe I'm just a hopeless optimist, and if that's my greatest flaw, trust me, that's not my only flaw.
That's the case. I think that I think you need optimism, and I think optimism makes things, you know, because if you think about it, pessimism, you definitely are not going anywhere fast, if at all.
But if I could just say one final thing before I let you guys go and I get back to my family, is that I love this family, the Conley family, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And I love both of you guys and Elaine, and you know, you've all taught at FDIC and you've all seen how that event is, I don't know, I think it's just so amazing, because we don't ask any of those questions when we review the call for submission. We don't really care who you are, where you were born. I saw a dopey commercial the other day and it said, the zip code you're born in the United States can determine your future. Yeah, no shit. Where you're born anywhere in the world can determine your future. It's where you were born, for goodness sakes. That's how your worldview is going to get, you know, formed. And, you know, it's not everybody's going to be born in Rockefeller Center or Beverly Hills, you know. I certainly wasn't, you know, and my kids weren't. My kids went to the poorest school district in America. Moriarty High School at the time when they were there was the poorest school district in America. You know, just tough on them. But, you know, it's just the way it was, and you deal with it, right? You keep going. I mean, America's is about self-determination, perseverance, and guts, and this group has all of that in spades. And you know, we bow to no one, and we kowtow to no one, and we apologize to no one for who we are or what we are, and I think that's important. I think that's really, really important, and that's why I'm so proud to be friends with you guys and Elaine, and always will be, because, you know, we're not apologists. We're not apologizing for anything, and never will, you know. And that doesn't mean we don't apologize our fans for mistakes or whatever we did or wrongs, but I mean, not for who and what we are.
Right.
You know, no way. And I love you, and I better get back to my family, or my wife is going to not let me eat with them tonight. See, Elaine, sometimes the women do win. I'm just kidding. Teasing you.
You better be back by the time we eat.
And actually, the only reason I really agreed to come on the show is because I knew you would be here, not these two lunkheads.
I know that.
So just so everybody knows, FDIC 2021, these fellas will be gracing the stage as keynoters together, and I know Elaine and I will be in the front row, just like the little rascals eating lemons and making faces at you. So can't wait to see you guys up there. Hey, I hope you had a wonderful Christmas. I hope you have a wonderful 2020. I can't wait to see you guys again, and thank you so much for letting me be on the show.
Thanks a lot,
Chief. One day, Bobby.
Love you. Bye-bye.
All right, so Chief Houghton is gone. Larry, you got some closing thoughts? Or
it's always interesting conversation. You just never know where the conversation is going to go on the Larry Conley Radio Show.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Like it's always real, it's always organic, and it's always think about
absolutely
play and play the podcast back. So but like I said, it's to make the world go round, you need that forward thinking, you need that optimism, and then you also need to make sure you keep it real and don't forget where things were, some things still are, and the way things used to be, because you tend to repeat that history. Mm-hmm. The cool thing about the fire service period is that we're a microcosm of the society, so. Mm-hmm. Hear about problems in the fire service. When it's not, you know, aliens from another planet that came here to protect the humans. You know, we come from these communities. We come from these ideologies. We come from these political beliefs and things like that. But I think what we've learned, continue to evolve and understand, is that when we respect each other's differences, mm-hmm. and learn how to put them in their proper place and come together and gel as a team to help these communities. That's what always gives us a unique lesson in humanity, I feel. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm so proud to be a firefighter, a St. Louis City firefighter, American firefighter, mm-hmm. firefighter period, the great family that it is, because this is, I mean, I don't know about the jobs, and I'm not trying to say our jobs are better than others, which it is. But no, but we have to. They can legislate all they want to, but we have to self-legislate ourselves, work together to truly help the people in the community. And if we don't, we don't have a long shelf life on this job. It's going to be a long career. You know, most firefighters retire after 20, 30 years. It's going to be a long, painful 20, 30 years for you if you don't learn those lessons. And even back in the day when it was, racism and sexism and every other kind of ism that tried to keep things apart, were always rearing their ugly head. There was always something that countered it, and that's why we've moved forward as well as we have in this industry. And these are the kind of things we celebrate every day when we go to work, and these are the kind of things we celebrate when we show up at conferences like FDIC and different conferences around the country that celebrate our profession. And I don't know about David. I know David's excited because he understands the magnitude of it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a huge honor for David and I to be gracing the stage for the keynote in 2021.
Mm-hmm. That's major.
And being able to take parts of this message that we've been talking about now, to make sure that we continue to rally the troops and continue to make our organization and our industry and our family the best thing to be a part of on the planet, and to be the lighthouse that we talk about for other industries and other people, because it is great, and I'm glad to be a part of it. I stumbled upon it. I didn't grow up chasing fire trucks. My uncle was a firefighter, and I didn't, hold the helmet and watch Bull take my dad out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, look like Kurt Russell or something. Mm-hmm. I didn't have none of that normal rock history, but stumbling upon this profession and all that is given to me and all I've been able to give back to it has been a great exchange. And I've roped the family into it, present company included. So,
mm-hmm. Very nice. I like the conversation today. It's always a good conversation with Chief Alden, and he has like a lot of historical knowledge and very interesting and unique life experience and perspective. And that's the beauty of, just what we're talking about a lot of times in our classes, but also just what we face every day, working with different folks in a country like America and, like what you guys face on the job, like the fire service, where you have to, work with people in an intimate setting, really closely with them, but their experience and their perspective may be a different side of the truth than yours, and again, I keep saying it because it's very important to not look at the fact that your perspectives are different as a thing that says that different perspective is deficient. There's a lot of merit in different perspectives, and a lot you can learn and a lot you can understand even about yourself and your own experience by listening to and really trying to empathetically understand the position and the life experience of the other person. And if everybody's doing that, I think that's how you get to a point where you don't have to legislate equality and diversity and things like that. You start actually being able to see the value in the life experience of the other person, in the perspective of the other person, and add some value to your own as well. That's how you do maintenance on equal high status. That's how you keep an equal high status, mutual victory type mindset and mentality and paradigm in your life, how you keep that in good shape. So if you were wondering how, this discussion tonight was a great example of how to do that. And then when you leave the table in love, and everybody is still family. And so I'm just excited about how that's able to happen, how that example even went down on this call. So another great episode as far as I'm concerned. I'm looking forward to FDIC, looking forward to what 2020 and beyond brings for us and for this message. So that's what I got.
Well, for me, I don't want to forget too, I had written down in my notes for you to elaborate a little bit more on the smoke detectors, not changing from what the topic wound up being, that firefighters actually will help you with the smoke detectors, or test them for you or something, won't they? That help you get them, help you.
You're asking about smoke detector installation?
It doesn't have to be a challenge for you to have your smoke detectors working or have smoke detectors, period. Is that you guys?
In the St. Louis City Fire Department, we installed the smoke detectors for free.
Okay.
We have a great grant program.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is that you call the St. Louis Fire Department, talk to our education officer, Captain Leon Whitener, give him a call and make the arrangements. And wherever you live in the city of St. Louis, that fire department, that firehouse that covers that area will come out and we'll install the smoke detectors free of charge. So there's no cost. You don't have to go wait in line. You don't have to save up your coins to do it. You can get it installed as early as you call tomorrow. And you get them installed as early as maybe that day if you call early enough, and or the next day. I mean, there have been times where somebody called that morning and we're back out the afternoon at the same house putting in the smoke detectors. So we do that because we're very serious and we're putting our money where our mouth is as far as making sure you get them in. So
I thought that was the case, and I just wanted to hear it, reiterated. So that anybody, in this area that needs it would know that they can do that. But back to our topic that sort of evolved, I think I like this kind of interaction because you get to hear different perspectives. And we don't need to, we were raised differently. We were culturally indoctrinated, if you will, differently. But people are going to have different perspectives. The key is to respect everybody's perspective. However, I have the intent, though, that even though I might have a different outlook or I had a different, I'm not going to ever know how it is to be a white woman in America. I mean, I'm just not. And no white woman is ever going to know how to be a black woman in America. And I won't even ever know how it is to be a man. So, but we have to still say, okay, in spite of that, the stuff I can't change, what I need to do is try to change the things I can change. And that's as a black woman in America. I don't have to carry any kind of anger around with me all the time about the things that I might have experienced in the past. Because now, as time has gone on, I've met some very, like Bobby and other white people, Caucasians, that were, became people that I had high respect for. And so, but still had a difference if we got into a dialogue, would not see eye to eye on certain things. And that's okay that we don't see eye to eye. As long as we're not trying to lower the status, and that's one of the things about the GLUE program that I just, one of my favorite parts is that status scenario that you guys do and talk about. Because I think that's like a root issue, is that you have presupposed that just because someone looks a certain way, is a certain gender, race, whatever, come from a certain part of town or whatever, that they're automatically, you assign a low status to that person. And then when you do that, that's to me where the trouble starts, where the gender of the problems is. And so if we can manage to help people in that area with programs like GLUE and some of the other good programs that are out here, and learn how to examine ourselves and evaluate that and get rid of what needs to be got rid of and maintain and enhance what needs to be maintained and enhanced. And so you're not going to completely erase everything that you might have learned along the way that had to do with another ethnicity or another gender, but you do have to modify and moderate how you see things, how you feel about people, and then begin to judge people on their own merit, but not just automatically lower their status just because of the color of their skin or just because of their gender. And so, or their religion or anything like that. So, but especially the things you can't change, because you can't change your color of your skin and your, you know, whether you were born, what ethnicity you were born into. So I think as long as we look at that kind of thing and remember that we were all created by the same creator, we're all equal, we all have our issues, and just be empathetic to that, then I think we will, we won't have to legislate as much of what people ought to do and ought not to do. And so, because I'm monitoring myself, and even though you may say something that I don't like, that's one thing, but you then try to keep me down. And one thing that Bobby said that I thought was interesting was when he said lowering the requirements. It sounds insulting, and it can be. However, if I didn't have the same education, and a lot of things were, I was deprived of a lot of things, and I brought myself along as best I could, and then you recognize that people who may have come from where I come from didn't have, and then you make the criteria such that it would be very difficult for me to qualify, then that's a problem. So you may need to, in making the law or changing the law, you may need to make an adjustment of some sort, because once you give me the opportunity, I can rise to the occasion. And so don't keep me out. And that may just because you don't see it that way, but sometimes it's deliberate. So just my point of view. But I love these kinds of sessions because I think that's what's necessary.
Most definitely is necessary. And I just think that, you know, all of us don't know everything. So, we just have to respect that each other. And I think it gets back to, I was going to mention it earlier when we were talking about the whole school desegregation thing, the status assignment was different. Mm-hmm. You had a different status assignment in a lot of inner city schools than you did in the county schools. Some of these kids that went out to the schools out in the suburbs, like they couldn't believe some of the
It's 17 hours.
And when they could believe some of the amenities that were going on out there, it was like, wow, you know, they got carpet out here.
They had books with you know, paper in it. So
if you had that, you know, that type of exposure, so to speak, and you had that same or equal type of status assignment, urban schools, because what they found out later is that busing cost so much money that they could have took that same money and bought books, put some carpet in the school, you know, could have did something to really reinvest to make sure that all the schools were operating in equal high status. And that's what it was all about in the first place, because once you did that desegregation, what you end up doing is feeding more of the status there. And like I said, it depleted the status in the neighborhood. Schools start to close, you know, the different, the accreditation was lost, and just different things when you disengage from a situation, you'll find that it will whittle and die in a lot of cases. So
So a lot of the stuff we have to just rethink it, and just like David and I teach all the time, assign stuff to people high standards. Assign stuff to people high standards. Fix it different.
Yes.
Fix it differently than maybe a quick fix or a reactionary knee-jerk kind of deal. And effects, then it can be more damaging than good, even though it might mark it as good on the front end. It can have some damaging effects. So the long-term thing is to keep the equal house status. Yeah.
Foundation.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, we're getting ready to wrap this session up. Happy New Year going into the new year. We won't talk to you until next year. Like I said, next year, David and I will be in Jackson, Missouri on the 27th of January. We'll be in Fenton, Missouri on the 28th. We're going to be doing glue in those two areas. And we're going to be working. And those classes, if you want to attend them, will be free. Compliments of the Missouri Division of Fire Safety and Fire Education Commission. If you want more information about the class in Jackson, Missouri, contact Training Officer Greg Heck. You can be reached at 573-243-8090, Heck, HBCHT. For Fenton on the 28th, Deputy Chief Tom Mueller, and his phone number is 314-920-1064. Down in January the 20th, we'll be in Florida, and we'll be there for the Human Relations Conference with the IAFF. And we were down there 2 years ago, had a great turnout, great feedback, great energy. We're going back again to do it again, and we're going to have a great time down there. We'll be down there January 21st down the Disney World down there. So, and then David, he'll have his class at FDIC, I think April 20th, for his 4-hour class. And come check out the hour and 45 on April 22nd. And we'll be doing that from 3:30 to 5:15 at FDIC. So we'll be at FDIC all week as usual. I'm not only going to be there for what we do, but we'll be working with another great organization, the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, the ISFSI. And the Fools will be there, so I'll be hanging out with the Fools. So it'll be a great time in Indianapolis, April 20th through the 25th. So come on out, start saving your coins, and come on out, have a good time. Learn some stuff, do some networking, take it back, influence your departments, and continue to help us make this a great fire service, American Fire Service. And then after that, we got some more dates, but check us out at www.gluenationldc.com to see where we're going to be. Those are just a few teasers at the beginning of the year going into the spring, but we definitely have some more things we're working on, so that could change as far as the schedule is concerned. But excited to be on the road again. David and I are going to be doing it again. Open up 2020 like we've done for the last, we're going on 10 years now, Dave. So
yeah.
It's going to be, it gets better each time, and we learn something each time. And I think we're now going to be talking about revamping a few things to add even more scenarios. So if you think you got these scenarios down pat, don't sleep on it, because we got some stuff coming down the pike that's going to really challenge you. So, get ready for getting another local thing. We're going to be in Columbia at Winter Fire School. Let me forget Winter Fire School. The guys over there are going to call and say, hey, buddy, call us. So I want to make sure that you make it out to Winter Fire School. We're going to be in Columbia, Missouri, and that's going to be February the 7th through the 9th, 2020. David and I will be there and doing our thing on Saturday. So come check us out at Winter Fire School as well. Check out the expo early. Doing the expo, I'll be at one of the booths at the Midwest Children's Burn Camp booth. Come by, get some information, and drop off some donations, because no kid goes to burn camp paying for it. We're there for free. And we only do that because of the donations. So we really appreciate that. In the meantime, all you firefighters out there, it's going to be a rough winter. So rough winter means, unfortunately, more fires and more chances to save lives. In some cases, hurt. So be careful out there as you do your job. We want to see everybody within the sound of my voice make it to FDIC this year, and then continue to go back home to your families for the rest of your career. Nobody has anything else. We're going to sign off and get this new year started off right. And we'll see you on the next edition of the Larry Conley Radio Show. By then, hopefully, David, we'll have the applause track.
We're still working on it. We have to actually get some people willing to applaud. I think that's the big, but we can talk about it offline.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And don't forget, mark your calendars, FDIC 2021. We're going to be
keynotes.
This year we're going to have, like I said, John Austin and Frank Fiscal.
That sounds like a singing group, the keynote.
Right.
Be sure you make it this year, 2020, to see those outstanding speakers. I'm going to try to get at least one of them when we do the live show from FDIC.
That'd be cool.
Stay tuned in and stay tuned. Thanks, David. Thanks, Elaine. And thanks, Bobby Hall.
All right.
Bobby.